As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance On Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App. First order academics on statistics and central limit theorem, Subrata Rajapa, joins us now with our question on debt, our conversation of the day, head of U.S. rate strategy at the Derivative Force, Societe Generale. Subrata, I'm going to cut to the chase and go a little bit mathy here. In the equity markets, we talk about a collar. Maybe even in commodity markets, we talk about a collar trend of copper, live cattle, whatever. What is your world like when the two-year yield is collared? How do you respond to a banded trade on yield in the derivative space?
So basically, Tom, you have all yields across the curve in the treasury market have been very range bound. You're looking at a range for 2 years around 4%, maybe 4.25 to 3.75. Same with 10-year as well. It's been in a very, very tight range. So really what that tells me, broadly speaking, is that there's really no strong conviction in the market on yields going either, monotonically higher or lower, broadly speaking, because of the fact that we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. In some respects, the data that we've gotten so far has been very, very strong. The consumer is resilient. The employment picture is relatively strong. Inflation is sticky. That would all argue for much higher yields from here on. But then you have the debt ceiling overhang, the regional banking crisis, as well as rates being policy rates being high and sticky. That would argue for perhaps right. lower yields over the longer run. So we're kind of stuck in this range because of that.
When you are stuck, can you model out for higher in the case of where we are in the range right now? Can you model out a bet for higher yield and lower price?
It's hard because ultimately what you're looking at, especially in this environment, is for the Fed to pause. We're not talking about perhaps a pause, a skip, and then another hike later on this year, perhaps. All that means is that if policy is going to remain restrictive for the remainder of the year, then that would mean ultimately that you're going to see a slowdown in the economy. That's kind of what the Fed wants to achieve in order to bring down inflation. And that will ultimately mean lower yields. So, we have a recession penciled in for early 2024. The economy looks relatively robust up until that point on. But then once we do go into a recession, then the Fed's going to have to cut rates. So the ultimate destination is perhaps for lower yields. The path between here and there is uncertain, given the fact that you have a lot of dynamics to get through over the short term as well as the medium term.
So, Badri, you mentioned the regional banking crisis is potentially helping to drive down inflation. What regional banking crisis? It seems like it stabilized. We seem to swing between it not existing, not having ever percolated, and suddenly still being a full-blown issue that's going to help the Fed. Which is it?
So the regional banking crisis, broadly speaking, the headlines have definitely abated. You're seeing a little bit more stability in the banking sector. But broadly, the transmission mechanism from the regional banking crisis is going to come from the credit crunch or tighter credit conditions. It's going to come from a greater regulation, if you will, of both the smaller mid-size as well as the larger banks. That would, broadly speaking, would tighten credit conditions as we progress through the year. You're seeing mortgage rates start to rise. You're seeing real yields at around 1.4%. So that's also risen in the last few weeks. So broadly speaking, I think higher yields as well as tighter regulatory framework it should lead to tighter credit conditions over the remainder of the year. So yes, it might not be a crisis in the regional banking sector as of now, tighter credit conditions are here to stay.
Do you believe that right now that's going to perhaps constrain yields going forward, that that's really the key feature, the H8 reports that come out on Friday that determine really what that band is that yields can trade within?
Yeah, I think over the near term, yields are definitely constrained. You're probably going to see an environment where the 2-year is going to struggle to get past 4.25% because that would imply the market pricing out a lot of the cuts that are priced in, perhaps even starting to price in for hikes at upcoming meetings. That doesn't seem to be in the cards. Powell seems to be squarely in the camp of pausing rates, at least in the June meeting, and then taking it meeting by meeting thereafter. So in that sort of context, I think 2 years are going to struggle to rise meaningfully from here. And as far as the long end is concerned, it's much more pegged to the outlook for growth, not just in the U.S., but also globally. China has had a good year this year for growth. GDP is going to be positive. But again, for upcoming years, you're looking at a meaningful slowdown in not just U.S., but also global growth. That should kind of keep the long end pegged and then ultimately decline over the coming months as well as next year.
More Fed speak through today. Can't wait. Bullard Bostic Daily speaking throughout this morning and this afternoon. Savadra, thank you. Savadra Jaffa there of SocGen.
Christopher Marinac joins us now, Director of Golf at Janney Montgomery Scott. He's not here to talk bank stocks. He's here to talk. We saw Oak Hill in the PGA this weekend, and you live next door to Augusta as well. Very cool. Give us a little vignette here after this spectacular weekend of golf, including a hole-in-one by the PGA Pro from California. Give us a picture of your Augusta. What's it look like?
Oh, it's the prettiest place on earth, but it's also a golf course that actually gets totally taken apart in the summertime. So when they close next week, they'll be closed for 3-4 months, and they'll take the entire place apart and redo the greens, redo a lot of things, certainly fix up a few trees that fell back in April. But it's an incredible piece of property.
It may be a place to relax when you're dealing with the bank stocks as well. Are you at any point a master's relaxation about the banking crisis, or is it still very vivid on a Monday morning?
Well, it's early innings. We have a lot to go. I mean, we still have a recession to find and then real estate to work through. And the banks, I think, will continue to make money throughout this whole journey, but they certainly have issues to deal with the next 3 years.
It seems like the move is toward greater capital requirements. We're hearing that from Neil Kashkari today. And we got a little hint of that today from the J.P. Morgan Investor Day. What did we hear from them?
Well, J.P. Morgan talks about their fortress balance sheet all the time. So, their slides are no different this morning about that. I think their leadership position in the banking industry is second to none. And so they're going to continue to remind everybody that capital is king. The stress tests come out in about a month. And my sense is the Fed's going to pass most, if not all, the banks, but they're going to politely ask for more comfort capital and require banks to raise additional equity.
Which banks?
I think the banks in the stress test, and then that will get pushed down to regional banks. So, the pretty much the rules work that anything that happens at the top 20 banks will get pushed down to the next 20 and the next 20. So it kind of falls from the top down.
We talk about the potential for just profitability constraints within some of the regional banks. How much will the profitability be further constrained and their lending mechanisms be curtailed if there is greater capital requirements foisted on them by the Fed?
Well, capital is going to naturally improve for the banks because of retained earnings. And I think there's a slight comeback on their equity securities just because you have natural amortization and payoffs of their HTM and available for sale securities. The challenge is going to be that raising additional capital to cover what could be a future credit cycle in 24 and 25. That's why the capital, I think, goes up. We still have those unrealized losses that are not going to go to zero. They're just going to get incrementally better.
Should people buy individual stocks, ETFs, BKX? What's the intelligent way to play this 3 years out?
Well, I think a basket of stocks across all market caps makes sense. It's not just the large cap. I think looking at mid cap and small community banks makes a bunch of sense. A lot of those are even cheaper than the regional banks that have been hit. My sense is that there is a real opportunity in these companies, many of which are trading below tangible book value, and tangible book value is growing.
Every now and again, TK and I take a stroll up Park Avenue. Bramo doesn't like to be with us publicly. And when T and I walk up...
This is pretty funny, guys.
It's true.
Just saying.
I mean, like on air, but not outside of the building. We go up Park Avenue and we go past the First Republic. On the next corner, the next block is a Chase private client, almost immediately.
Sure.
And on those screens in First Republic, they're playing Bloomberg. And I often always think of them because, you know, right now we're talking about them and they're looking up at those screens and they're watching us talk about them. Can you tell me what's going to happen with those branches? Does anyone know?
I think they'll stay the same for probably a year or two and quietly change gears, maybe become a second JP Morgan office. Maybe they'll become something else. Most likely, it's going to be a slow play.
You don't think they're just going to immediately come out with a knife and just cut all these branches and close them?
I don't think so. They gave expense guidance this morning. That's the same that they had before, excluding the FRC.
We heard from Janet Yellen that there is going to be more consolidation akin to that First Republic getting acquired by JP Morgan. How much more, and is JP Morgan still in the business of acquiring, or is it going to be sort of the other Bank of America, the other big banks?
I think it might be nothing, actually. I think that the consolidation may have already happened because you have three banks that failed in March and April, and that represents about 4% of the assets for those big regional banks. You know, the interesting thing to me is if you look at the top 25 banks in the country, they represent 2/3 of the assets in the FDIC deposit. So why do we need consolidation when you already have 2/3 held there? So I think the consolidation may be greater, mid-size and smaller.
So every analyst who comes on talks about the regional banking crisis as something that's going to tighten credit conditions and actually help the Fed. Are you pushing back and saying that's not really the case because it's over?
Well, I'm not sure the crisis really ever happened. I think we had mishaps in the month of March with these failed banks, but largely those were their own doing. I think the rest of the contagion that's been limited to PacWest, Western Alliance, both of which seem to be stabilizing. PacWest has positive news out this morning on asset sales. I think that the rest of the industry is marching ahead. You know, we have seen deposit outflows in the industry for sure, and those may continue just because interest rates need to catch up for depositors. But most of these banks are lending money, making a profit, and marching forward. So I think there is tighter credit anyways, but it's not as bad and as negative as I think headlines have suggested.
The heritage of Jenny Montgomery Scott is Philadelphia, the mid-Atlantic states, and all the roll-up there that happened 30, 40 years ago in banking. When do the regionals finally act and consolidate? Waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. When do they finally say enough?
Well, you could see two or three mergers the next couple of years of those regional banks, but I'm not sure it's going to be that often. I really think it's going to be a lot less than we anticipate. The Fed has to really change gears at the examiner level to push these mergers. The last 2 years, mergers have taken forever to close, and a handful of them terminated. Just ask TD.
It's a people thing, the examiners?
Sure.
Interesting. Absolutely. Interesting.
Master's tickets. Have we nailed that down?
Yeah, we had. Chris is our new friend.
Okay, good.
The odds, according to Golf Digest, thank you, Simon, for this, to garner Masters tickets is a 1 in 200
1
odds.
In 200. That's through the lottery.
The lottery, whatever they have.
Okay.
Yeah, I just have to applied last
people.
Year and went
got to
down
know
in
people,
flames.
Bramo. Do you know people?
No.
Okay. We know Christopher Marinac.
But Chris knows people.
He knows people that we know.
That's good to know.
He nods.
Well, it's good to know you, Chris. Thanks for being with us. Chris Marinac, Jenny Montgomery Scott.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Let's go to a guest here right now to give us perspective here with all the different news flow. We have Lisa Hornby's head of U.S. multi-sector fixed income at Schroders. Oh, the yield move that we have lifted up, does it take us up to a collar edge, yields up to resistance, or is there something going on here, Lisa, that's original?
You know, I think the market is still flirting with this idea of is there a path where things can actually be okay? And certainly resolution on the debt ceiling, which was last week's optimism or cause for optimism, is a step towards that path. Of course, I think we'll have some fits and starts between now and then. And I don't think we'll see the highest end of the 10-year range where the peaks that we got to last year. But I think, I think there could be some tactical trading opportunity here for sure.
What are you doing on duration? We hardly touched on it this morning. Not so much the price move or yield move, but the bet you place in maturity.
Yeah, I think duration, the outlook for bonds in our view this year has been compelling. I think we're 10 years, we're probably looking at a range of 325 to 375. So we're getting towards that upper band. We like tactically trading, but erring towards being long because our view is for economic deterioration. It's kind of a slow burn, but I think that that's where we're headed. And so we want to come out the other side of this long, but understanding this is going to be a volatile market as it really has been for the last 4 or 5 months.
Alisa, where are you seeing that signs of economic deterioration at the moment?
So certainly a slow grind, but we are starting to see it on the consumer side. It's obviously very gradual, but we have seen credit card balances tick up. We have seen on the auto loan side, now really across the FICO spectrum, a bit of deterioration. Obviously, jobs still remain very, very resilient. One of the things we're watching, though, closely is small businesses. Small business surveys have really deteriorated over the last, I want to say, more than a year. And that deterioration, in our view, is probably set to increase as credit conditions tighten for these guys, particularly in light of what's going on the regional banking side. So that's where we're focused. We have to remember small businesses in the U.S. employ a very large percentage of the population. We spend a lot of time talking about the GEs of the world, but probably 90% of businesses in the U.S. are small, small to mid-size. So their outlook is pretty important, and it's not particularly compelling when you look at the data.
We just had Chris Marinac on over from Janney Montgomery Scott, and he was talking about the regional banking crisis that wasn't. And so I wanted to get your sense of what is happening in terms of the credit tightening. He said that regional banks are a much better position than people assume. They're not constraining their lending mechanisms all that much. Do you see something different, or do you think it just hasn't happened yet, but just wait and it will?
I think it's a bit of a slow burn, right? The cost of capital has gone up. These regional banks are under increased scrutiny. I think there will be more focus on balance sheet preservation and the type of loan making that they're doing. And I think certain pockets of the economy will see a little bit more stress as a result of that and make it a bit harder to access capital. I mean, Tom said it before while I was listening in earlier, the cost of capital has risen and that poses an issue. And it's supposed to pose an issue, right? The Fed is doing this intentionally to try and slow economic growth, and they're doing it, but it takes some time.
Given how resilient the economy has been, and given that we haven't really seen the credit stress materialize in a way as significant as many people had expected at this point, what is the risk that the Fed's going to have to tighten further? It's going to have to hike again, perhaps even in June, because maybe the constraint isn't that great from the regional banks just yet, and that it will have to be this slow burn that goes on for a while.
Yeah, I mean, the market is certainly flirting with that, right? We've seen the probability of a Fed hike at the next meeting move, vary between 25 and 40%. If we get a debt ceiling resolution in the near term, I wouldn't be surprised to see that move higher. I think the Fed wants to be cautious. I mean, if you listen to Powell's comments last week, he didn't explicitly suggest a pause here, but he did allude to the fact that, hey, we've done a lot. We could potentially be patient and see what the impact is. I mean, they are breaking things, right? There are more, look at the MOVE index and where it's been over the last year versus the previous several years. Things are starting to percolate in the background, and we have had several banks now fail. I don't know that story is completely played out. I think that they realize that there are now some risks out there that are becoming a bit more serious. And so all else equal, I'm sure they would prefer to pause, but we have a lot of data between now and the middle of June, their next meeting. So we'll have to wait and see.
Well, let's just finish there, Lisa. Clearly, you're not going to keep on hiking until you see 2%. Do you think we've seen sufficient evidence right now that they are sufficiently restrictive? Or is this a guess based on the cumulative tightening that they've already delivered?
I think it's a great question. My sense is they've probably done enough. They might go a little bit further because they're looking at data on a lag. If we could fast forward 6 months from now, I suspect that inflation will continue to slow and that they will get, you know, be closer to their targets and growth will be starting to roll over in a more serious way. But, you know, if we get another 5.5% inflation print, that all bets are off. So I think unfortunately, the way monetary policy works is with a lag. And so they'll react to the data as it comes in rather than, you know, 6 months or 12 months from now, trying to see the bigger picture.
Hey, Lisa, this was great. Lisa Hornby there, a Schroders. Appreciate it as always. Michael O'Leary, CEO of Ryanair, joins us right now. Michael, great to see you in New York. Good to see you, mate, as always.
$15.
It's not bad, is it? So, Michael, tell me this. Is that the future still, or have things changed?
It is the future, and things are changing. I mean, I think, you know, we've ordered another 300 aircraft from Boeing 2 weeks ago. So, you know, we're going to grow from 149 million passengers pre-COVID to 300 million passengers by the early 2030s. So there's still lots of growth for Ryanair. But growth is getting easier in Europe. The market has consolidated post-COVID. Capacity has come out. I mean, we're looking across Europe this summer where we're operating 25% more seat capacity than we had pre-COVID. But the rest of the market's only operating at about 90%. So we're taking huge amounts of market share from everybody else. We're well hedged on fuel. We're offering really low airfares. But those low airfares are up a bit. Like, we expect our lowest airfare to rise probably 5, 10% a year for the next couple of years because of this capacity constraint. And with the manufacturer's challenge, Boeing and Airbus, huge backlog on orders, can't increase monthly production because supply chain difficulties for the next 4 or 5 years. I think you're looking at a European marketplace that will now copy some of America in the last decade, stable capacity and more reasonable pricing going forward.
Is that good for you and bad for the people travelling?
I think it's good for us. It's also good for the people travelling. But the challenge is, if you look at the German market this year, for example, Lufthansa, which was bailed out by the German government to the tune of 13 billion during COVID, they've only restored 80% of their pre-COVID capacity. Airfares in Germany have doubled this year over last year. So, you know, German consumers are being stiffed by their national champion and they're increasingly turning to us because we have capacity growth. I'm taking 50 aircraft a year from Boeing. Because we have capacity growth, we can keep fares down. But I have no doubt in my mind that one of the big drivers of Ryanair's growth the next couple of years is going to be the incumbent legacy carriers really driving airfares much higher in Europe than they are in the US.
Are you willing to then just have a commensurate increase in your price, just perhaps less?
Absolutely not, Lisa. We're going to keep growing capacity. We will remain load factor active, yield passive. We intend to take huge amounts of market share from every incumbent in Europe as we grow our share in Europe from about 20% now to about 33% in the early 2030s.
People talk about the travel boom that has really supported services globally as being a bit of YOLO. You only live once after the pandemic. Get out there and travel. And if you're not dealing necessarily with the business segment as much, how confident are you that that's going to continue in perpetuity?
Perpetuity is a long time. I mean, it's too long for my horizon. Next 5 years, it's going to continue. There's a couple of fundamentals in Europe. One, we're seeing very strong business growth. I mean, businesses are flying around Europe, particularly to kind of Eastern Europe, Morocco, Portugal, repairing supply chains that they can no longer depend on Asia. And they're looking to find cheap manufacturing in Morocco, Portugal, Poland, Romania. We're the biggest airlines in those markets. So we're seeing a very strong recovery in our business travel. I think people who are locked up for 2.5 years are going back traveling. And that's not a short-term phenomenon. Travel increasingly. I mean, what really surprises me about the moment, for all the negative coverage of higher energy prices, price inflation, there's still fundamentally full employment in Europe. People are getting paychecks at the end of every month, and what they do is they go travelling. Mm-hmm. Leisure time is rising. You have kids who are all over Europe. I mean, when I grew up in the 70s and 80s, as my children keep reminding me, that was the last century, we went around Europe by train.
Thank you.
You know, you're interrailing. Now they go around Europe on Ryanair. This summer, huge US flows into Europe. The Asian market is recovering. But because only 90% of the pre-COVID capacity has been restored, demand is strong and pricing is strong. And I see no reason why that won't continue for a 4 or 5 year period. Now, there'll be curveballs, COVID, Ukraine invasions, things like that will throw us off course. But the underlying fundamentals are very strong. Demand for travel is strong and supply is constrained by aircraft manufacturers. There's a cap on what they can build and how fast they they can increase production.
I've got an aerospace team with a lot of really smart questions. Here's the only question our listeners and viewers care about. It looks like the U.S. airfares are a complete scam. I looked at a quick eyeball, $60, $70 round trip on Ryanair versus $300 in the same flight in America, roughly. And I look at the margin you're making, 12 cents modeled on the dollar versus 6-7 cents at, say, Kirby's wonderful United Airlines. Why can't America get this right? Why aren't you in America?
One, because there's so much growth for us in Europe. Why would I want to go to America when we can deploy all of this growth in Europe? And Europe is still fundamentally underexploited. Europe is moving towards consolidation. I think the American airlines have slightly overplayed it. You know, we look at Southwest, and, you know, Southwest was kind of heroic model for us when we first started this 30 years ago. But Southwest is no longer fundamentally a low-cost airline. You know, its average ticket price is $110, $120 a seat. My average ticket price last year was 40 euros a seat. So I think, you know, more needs to be done there. Don't, you know, more capacity needs to be found in the American industry. But the challenge is going to be for all of us, because Boeing and Airbus can't fundamentally increase their production rates. We're going to be, this industry is going to be challenged for the next 4 or 5 years. And I think we have to be careful not to repeat what's happening in the States. We don't want to push pricing too high. And that's, I think, why our 300 aircraft order with Boeing is so key to keeping prices low and people traveling across Europe for the next decade.
You could buy some capacity. You mentioned consolidation. You interested in that?
No. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, I'm buying somebody else's problems.
Great.
But I'm very happy in Europe to see Lufthansa buy Alitalia, let's see IAG buy TAP.
I bet you are.
You know, consolidate away. And you'll need to consolidate, because none of you are going to are able to compete with Ryanair, because we have much lower costs than you, we have much lower fares than you. So you better well, but may as well
great
consolidate.
Great balance sheet too. So if you don't want to play the consolidation game, you're sitting there with a great balance sheet, no debt right now. Right?
No. We're paying debt down aggressively.
Paying it down.
We've no net debt. We're zero net cash.
No net debt. Fantastic. Yeah. Okay, capital returns?
I think it's coming, just not yet. I mean, we're paying down debt at the moment. I've paid two bonds this year, $1.5 billion of debt. I've only got about $2 billion of debt left. I paid that all down in 2025 and 26. I'm spending about $2.5 billion a year in CapEx, which I'm funding out of internally generated cash flow. And once we get through that, I think maybe next year, right, if we have another strong year and we have significant net cash balances, then we'll return those to shareholders.
Ryanair, 26% debt, UAL, 70% debt.
It's a big difference, isn't it? Just a massive difference. Yeah. This was fun, Michael. Got to do this more often.
We do. I got to come back to the States more often.
You see, bring your damn airline to the States? Lisa and I are getting absolutely crushed.
I want to know
what
the secret is. I mean, why some people can offer $40 or 40 euros.
Double it. 80, 90. I mean, double it. 80, 90 compared to 300. It's ridiculous.
You look through history, the Irish have always been, you know, we've been transport pioneers. We built the roads, we built the railways, and now we're building the air. We're going to dominate the skies across Europe. Okay. Come to Europe for low fares. Don't bother holidaying in the States.
You know, when you're back, we need to talk about a business traveler. I do wonder what's going to happen here. I remember EasyJet made a big transition years ago to get the business traveler, and I wonder if your cabin's going to change at all in years to come.
Absolutely not.
Over it's just going to remain the same? You're going to keep the same thing?
Business travel, what's different about it, people keep confusing short-haul and long-haul. What's different in short-haul is nobody will pay a premium for business travel. Business just want on-time, affordable, safe transport. They want to get there. Long-haul, 20% of the market will still pay a ludicrous premium on long-haul, which is why long-haul and short-haul is different. And we intend to continue to grow very strongly in Europe, with a huge growth in business travel as well as leisure travel out over the next decade. And I can only do that with my beloved aircraft partners, Boeing, who will now sell me 400 aircraft over the next 8 years.
Monaco this weekend?
No more sales pitch.
Monaco this weekend,
I don't think they fly to Monte Carlo.
We fly to Nice and Marseille.
There
we drive across
Perfect.
The border.
From New York City. Michael,
guys,
thank you.
Great
this was great. Thank you, buddy.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
We wake up again to another morning anticipating looking ahead to more talks on Capitol Hill. There are a range of estimates out there. Here's one from Goldman and the team, estimating that Treasury will drop below $30 billion in cash as soon as June 8th, but warning the following. The estimate is subject to substantial uncertainty, so there is certainly a chance the receipts could slow more than expected and leave the Treasury short of cash by June 1st or June 2nd. TK, we're taking this early June date, I think, increasingly seriously.
Absolutely. To me, that was the front line this weekend, and this is Yellen out front, and maybe it is the acuity of being an economist, where she put a bow on it earlier, and the bow's moving, and it's moving quickly towards June. The other thing that's moving, I would point, is the calendar. We were talking about this on May 10th. It's not May 10th. It's May 22nd.
No, we're running out of time, aren't we?
We're running out of time.
I think it's less about the mood of the moment, the mood music, so to speak, and much more about substance now. Let's get into the substance of it. What's the hang-up?
I would go with that. And the substance, of course, is the return of the president to Washington. In Tokyo is our Amory Horton, our Bloomberg Washington correspondent. Amory, there's points in a campaign where there's hallmarks along the way, not in the news flow, but maybe a research piece that's out there or an op-ed piece. This morning, the Washington Post drops a bombshell of an op-ed piece directly addressing the president's age. He returns to Washington for a debt debate, but he also returns to Washington looking at an 82nd birthday, etc., on election day. How's he going to deal with that when you get back there and keep asking him tough questions?
Well, I think that's exactly what the president needs to be doing for the public to put rest aside these concerns. He's going to have to get in front of the public, take questions from the press like he did yesterday at the end of the G7 summit. And that potentially can assuage voters' concerns about his age. But Tom, I don't really think this is a bombshell. I think everyone has been talking about this,
yes,
whether or not the whispers are getting now louder echoes. But everyone has been talking about this because it shows up in polls. Americans are concerned about his age. But also, in the same age bracket, I would say, is the nominee right now that's leading the Republican candidate for president, and that's the former president Donald Trump. He's just 4 years behind Biden. So regardless, we're going to have a president, if it was to be a rematch of these two individuals, a president ending that next term in their 80s.
Yeah, and John, that was clearly addressed by the Washington Post in the op-ed piece. It was not just about President Biden.
You wake up this morning, you just get the feeling G7, what G7? Anne-Marie, what did they talk about? Because the president had to leave at dinner early, even on the way back, reportedly on Air Force One, had to take a call with Speaker McCarthy. He's going to land, engage in talks almost immediately. Did he ever really leave behind the domestic issues?
I think it's fair to say he had one foot here in Japan and one foot back home in Washington. He even brought Bruce Reed with him to make sure that there was an individual on the team keeping in touch with his key negotiating team in Washington. As you said, he left a dinner early to have a phone call with his team. He was constantly kept up to date on where the negotiations were, but the negotiations over the weekend were very much so on and off. Breaking that impasse last night was this phone call the president had while he was on Air Force One with Speaker McCarthy. Speaker McCarthy then came out and said it was productive. He also, really for one of the first times it's been since the president's been abroad, did not criticize his trip abroad and just said, we're going to meet tomorrow. So that's today. President Biden and Speaker McCarthy, these two men in a room. And this is how a deal is going to be able to get over the finish line, because it's really just these two individuals being able to come to an agreement. Biden alluded to that in the press conference, saying, I guess he wants me to get home to be able to hammer out this negotiation. So that's where all eyes are. And I think, you know, there's other topics, obviously, at the G7. China was a massive focus. President Zelensky was here in person. Russia was a massive focus. But for other world leaders and their concerns about future economic risks. When the President of the United States is in the room, that question would be going to him. Sir, are you going to have a default on treasuries, which is the bedrock and it underpins our entire global financial system? So it loomed large over him.
And Maria, I guess there's another way to reframe this and build on what John's talking about. Was this G7 a waste of time with the focus entirely on whether the U.S. would get its ducks in a row back at home? Or were there some really substantive things that took place, in particular having to do with China, with a communique that the Financial Times described as the strongest condemnation of China yet, and really a tit-for-tat with China and Micron over the weekend that really left me highly confused about whether we're thawing or exacerbating the tensions?
I think this week was a key week when we will look back in history in terms of a more multipolar world. Not only do you have Zelensky here at the G7, formerly this was a G8, where President Putin used to think of this club he was part of in a very prestigious way. Zelensky was here, some 600 miles away from Russia's Far East. At the same time, you had Zelensky in the Middle East. Clearly for Putin, he's seeing that the Middle East is no longer in his bag. And then you also had China's Xi Jinping last week sitting down with five ex-Soviet states. So you can see there are changing movements in the geopolitical world. And when it comes to some substance that happened here on the foreign policy front, it was all about China. And the president reiterated that yesterday in his press conference. What this administration and the Europeans have really been able to coalesce around is language about not decoupling, but de-risking. And I asked the president's deputy national security advisor for economic affairs, Mike Pyle, what's the difference? And he said, look, de-risking means we don't want China to get a hold of advanced technology for their military. We have concerns about economic coercion and their market practices. But how can you call something a decouple when U.S.-China trade was at a record last year? So that is the framework that we are going into. But Lisa, you also bring up a great point. Just hours after we got this communique, China came out and said that Micron did not pass their cybersecurity review. And one thing Rahm Emanuel, the U.S. ambassador to Japan, said to me was, we're no longer really just seeing China take these economic coercions against nations. They're now going against companies. So I think this was really a pivotal moment, really, in the geopolitical landscape this week, even though domestic concerns were definitely front and center.
MH, brilliant coverage over the week, over the weekend, and this morning as well. Anne-Marie, thank you. Out of Japan, following the G7.
Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.